Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.
Our sport is a risky sport.
We are at the mercy of the mountain itself. Rock covered in snow and ice. The risk of avalanches from bad weather.
Hypothermia. Altitude sickness.
Exhaustion. It's not a natural environment for survival.
Chasing mountains. Listen now by searching for amazing sports stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and in the early hours of Sunday, the 28th of April, these are our main stories. 30 years on from the first democratic elections in South Africa, President Ramaphosa outlines the event's importance.
South Africa, our country, changed forever. It signaled a new chapter in the history of our nation, a moment that resonated across Africa and across the world.
A new video of two Israeli hostages is posted by Hamas. The released daughter of one of the men said,
I demand that the leaders of this country watch this video and see their own father crying out for help.
Australia holds a nationwide weekend of rallies to highlight the scourge of violence against women. Also in this podcast, experts say a hole in the ozone layer over Antarctica is exposing wildlife to the sun's most harmful rays. And
they thought I was only a little child in here. I'm an old lady.
The passenger, aged 101, who was classed as being just one by an airline. Thirty years ago this weekend, for the first time, millions of black South Africans voted in their country's democratic elections, a right they'd been denied by a white minority government under the apartheid regime. On Freedom Day, on Saturday, President Cyril Ramaphosa honoured those he said had brought peace and freedom to South Africa. In an address at the main ceremony in Pretoria, he described the first democratic elections back in 1994 as a victory for human dignity and reconciliation.
The democratic breakthrough that we achieved was much about liberating South Africans from apartheid, as it was about freeing white South Africans from their prejudice and fear. As President Nelson Mandela said, the system of apartheid robbed both the oppressed and the oppressor alike of their humanity.
But 3 decades later, all is not well in the Rainbow Nation. Ahead of crucial elections next month, South Africans are asking serious questions about whether the promises made by the democratically elected African National Congress have been delivered. The BBC's Southern Africa correspondent Nomsa Maseko has been speaking to some of them.
Vilakazi Street here in Orlando, West Soweto, carries a rich history. South Africa's first black president, Nelson Mandela, and Archbishop Desmond Tutu once lived here. With the country struggling with a high unemployment rate, many are relying on tourism here as visitors come to learn about the history of the struggle against the racist apartheid system. Street performers sing and dance, restaurants serve food, and traders sell clothes and souvenirs. Just a 10-minute drive away is a very different Soweto to the one most tourists see. People here are disillusioned. Tasnima Sylvester is a 38-year-old mother of three.
How do you feel about celebrating 30 years of democracy?
I don't feel there's something to celebrate because I'm unemployed. No running water, no toilets. There's basically no services for us here.
Are you going to be voting this year?
No, because I haven't seen any changes that the ANC has done. I usually vote, but this year I won't. Democracy means nothing to me.
One of the best examples of the service delivery crisis that extends in all directions is that hundreds of trained medical doctors have been staging protests because they can't find work. They're demanding permanent jobs, both because they need to live and they want to serve.
I'm Dr. Mumtaz Imran Thomas. People call me Dr. Taz.
Dr. Taz is the first graduate in her family. She's surviving on freelance work outside of the medical fraternity.
30 years of democracy for me has afforded me the opportunity to be a coloured female medical doctor, the first generation medical doctor in my family. However, it's also highlighted a very sad reality. The people of South Africa are in dire need of healthcare. Yet, we have a collapsing healthcare system, and that's why we have 800 unemployed doctors. So 30 years of democracy, what that means for me is being robbed of opportunity and hope that was once promised to us.
Political violence in the years right before the 1994 vote almost derailed South Africa's own transition to democracy. Conflict over the tactics for opposing apartheid broke out between supporters of the African National Congress and the Inkatha Freedom Party. Black communities were mostly affected. I met men who risked their lives for the ANC during the conflict. Dumisani Khumalo is one of them.
We are still growing. We are still a very young democracy. If you look at it, 30 years is not a very long time. Mm-hmm. The apartheid government was in power for 48 years. Mm-hmm. We've moved. We've got a lot of gains. Like the government is trying to bring services to the people. We're trying to move.
With upcoming elections on the 29th of May, South Africa is counting the gains of the last three decades, with many asking what the next 30 years hold for the Rainbow Nation. While turnout at the last election was the lowest since 1994, many South Africans still believe in the power of the ballot box. Here's Dr. Tez again.
Voting was the one thing that instilled hope into South Africa, and it can still be that one thing that instills hope back into South Africa.
Dr. Taz ending that report by Nomsa Maseko. Ukraine says there's fierce fighting between Russian and Ukrainian troops over an area of the Donetsk region in the east of the country. It comes as Russia has again inflicted heavy damage to Ukraine's energy infrastructure. In Kharkiv, in the northeast of the country, a psychiatric hospital was almost hit, an attack that prompted the city's mayor, Ihor Terekov, to make this appeal.
The main task is to close the sky over Kharkiv. For this, we need the most modern air defences. Of course, this could only be achieved with the help of our international partners. I once said that the international community must unite around Kharkiv, so that it doesn't turn into another Aleppo.
President Zelensky insists that every Russian missile and drone could be shot down if Ukraine is provided with more air defences. Our correspondent James Waterhouse is in southern Ukraine.
Well, even by the standards of this war, this was a night of busy skies where you have the Ukrainian authorities saying that Russia launched 34 missiles from land, sea and air, and it was a large-scale attack where you have these power stations reportedly hit in the far westerly parts of Ukraine, as well as in the east, around the eastern city of Dnipro, as well as Kharkiv city in the northeast, where we're told a psychiatric hospital was narrowly missed with 1,000 people inside. President Zelensky has used these strikes to renew his pleas for air defence systems. Yes, this Western aid is coming in, but he is saying Western allies have the resources to stop every Russian missile from hitting Ukrainian targets. So he's used that political opportunity. But this wasn't a night of one-way traffic. You have Russian authorities in the southern Krasnodar region saying they intercepted more than 60 drones launched by Ukraine. They say two oil refineries were hit, and there are reports that an airbase too. The US at one point warned Ukraine about hitting energy sites inside Russia over fears of energy price rises and an escalation in this war. It is clear from last night that Kyiv still does not share in those concerns.
James Waterhouse. Weeks of indirect negotiations between Hamas and the Israeli government have failed to secure a truce, with the fate of more than 100 Israeli hostages still held in Gaza a key sticking point. More than 6 months after the mass kidnappings, Hamas has posted another proof-of-life video. This time, two male hostages, Keith Siegel and Omri Wiran, appeared in the footage. Seemingly speaking under duress, they said they were hoping for a deal that would see them and the other hostages returned home. After seeing her father Keith in the video, Ilan Siegel urged Israel to make a deal.
Seeing my father today only emphasizes to all of us how much we must reach a deal as soon as possible and bring everyone home. I demand that the leaders of this country watch this video and see their own father crying out for help.
Benjamin Netanyahu's government has been under pressure from the families since October the 7th. The families have been holding regular protests demanding action. Our Middle East analyst Sebastian Usher reports now on Saturday's developments.
The three-minute video shows Keith Siegel, who's 64, and Omri Miran, who's 46, identifying themselves and saying they hope a deal can be made that would see them and other hostages returned home. Both men look gaunt. One mentions the Passover holiday, suggesting the video was filmed recently. It's the second hostage video that Hamas has published in the past few days. Hostage families in Israel have released a statement saying that Israel must choose between hostages or war, and that a planned military incursion into Rafah, the southernmost town in Gaza, would cause more of those who've been abducted to die. Talks on securing the release of the hostages and a ceasefire in Gaza have been continuing, but a deal has yet to be agreed. In Israel, big protests are again taking place demanding new elections and for the safety of the hostages to be the government's priority.
Sebastian Usher. In the United States, police have ended another pro-Palestinian student protest after the university authorities said the demonstrators were using what they called virulent anti-Semitic slogans. Northeastern University in Boston said about 100 people, a mix of students and outsiders, were detained. At Columbia University in New York, the epicenter of the protests, one student leader has been barred from the site, and officials are looking into how the protests there are being handled. From there, Nami Iqbal sent us this report.
We should make sure that CUNY administration knows that we will not back down.
Another day and another encampment has cropped up in the US. In this part of New York, students are camped outside the City College.
And last night, we succeeded in that.
Yes. Sarah is Palestinian-American.
And I'm here to risk it all for Palestine, and I think that's the bare minimum we can do. That's the bare minimum anyone can do. Students here and faculty here are not scared of anything. They know that there is a risk of arrest, they know there is a risk of suspension, but they're willing to stand here and risk it all for Palestine and for divestment.
Sergei once studied at this university.
I came here out of curiosity.
He describes himself as very pro-Israel.
I do find it unfair that certain groups are allowed to occupy public space, block people's access to those spaces. I do find it offensive when my people are accused of genocide when we defend ourselves. But at the same time, I do recognize freedom of speech, freedom of assembly, and to non-violently express their views, however much I disagree with them.
This protest is peaceful, but police are bringing in large silver barricades as the crowd gets bigger. Tensions between officers and students have led to an escalation across many parts of America. From Georgia to Texas to Ohio and California, there have been hundreds of arrests, with students accused of trespassing. The protests were started here by Columbia University students more than a week ago. Tensions have been fraught between those who are pro-Palestinian and those who are pro-Israeli, both sides accusing each other of hate speech. One student has since apologised for prior remarks, saying Zionists don't deserve to live. He's been barred from the protest site.
It's much calmer here at Columbia University today. I'm literally outside the encampment, so there's a black fence that runs all the way across. We're not allowed to enter the encampment as media. Security is tight given the events of the last few days. But people are milling about. There's a very positive atmosphere here. You've got many students who've got their laptops open, they're doing their schoolwork. And there are some people who have their faces covered, either with face masks or scarves. And they have said it's because they're worried, due to the political position they've taken, that it might result in them being kicked off their course, that their identity could compromise their future careers. But they also say that they are sticking to their demands. And what they're demanding, which is the same as students protesting at universities elsewhere in the country, is for their university leaders to cut economic and academic ties with Israeli institutions. And the students here say they're not budging until that happens.
Nomer Iqbal. An exhibition is underway at the British Library here in London on 50 years of black British music, covering the places where particular sounds were born, the people who created them, and their musical influences. The singer-songwriter Eddie Grant, who had hits in the 80s, including Electric Avenue and Gimme Hope Joanna, was one of the contributors. He spoke to Michel Hussein about the music that shaped him from the beginning, when he first came to the UK from Guyana at the age of 12.
Well, let's go back. I would have been hearing music from the border countries. Radio Luxembourg would have been the equivalent of music coming from Suriname. I would have been hearing loads and loads of the Mighty Sparrow.
Come, let we go, Lulu. It's a long time I'm watching you. Come, let we go, Lulu.
Sparrow was so far ahead of his contemporaries that it would have been a sin against God not to have been playing his music consistently in Guyana. Having left Guyana, confusion reigned because traditional jazz was very popular in England in the 60s, quite into the 70s, actually. I decided to get involved in making a kind of hybrid Jamaican, Guyanese, Trinidadian music. And Prince Buster would have been the person that I would have copied at that time.
Some say he's from St. Thomas, others say he's a Chilman.
Soul music made its appearance. You had a massive mixture taking place, and England being so small relative to America and having one real radio station, which was the BBC, the impact became very strong. You had then people like John Mayall's Blues Breakers, the Rolling Stones, the Beatles, coming up with all the exotica from America that back in London wouldn't have necessarily been in contact with. So they had a lot of catching up to do.
How conscious were you of the women who were coming through? I'm thinking in particular of Joan Armatrading and her very distinct sound.
Joan's music had a tremendous impact on pop music. And you can hear Joan in Tracy Chapman. You can hear almost every girl that has come out of English popular music has in some way been touched by Joan Armatrading. She was a one-off as far as English any music was concerned.
No conversation, no way goodnight.
And then in the 80s, Eddie, when you were having success with hits like Electric Avenue, and then you also went on to do Gimme Hope, Joanna, which was a sign of the times because it's an anti-apartheid song.
In my time, there were still the guys like Harry Beckett, Joe Harriet, and guys out of Africa. All of these guys were playing and contributing to what was being called white music at the time. You just got to be honest. Say what you've seen, say what you've heard, and it may be able to direct the future in some little meaningful way.
Rocket in the daytime.
Electric Avenue.
Rocket in the night.
And that was Eddie Grant speaking there to Michel Hussein. Still to come here on the Global News podcast, scientific evidence that some form of life might exist outside our solar system.
Of all the thousands of planets we know, this is the only planet currently known which is potentially habitable.
There were angry protests on the streets of Sydney, Australia on Saturday as demonstrators called for an end to violence against women, which organisers describe as a form of terrorism. They say it should be treated as a national emergency.
No more violence, no more hate!
1, 2, 3, 4!
We won't take it anymore!
Some campaign groups claim violence against women is at epidemic proportions and serious political action is desperately needed.
It comes down to educating our sons. I shouldn't have to tell my daughter how to dress, how to act, what to say, but I tell my son how to treat women and what relationships should be like.
I think the government needs to declare this devastating thing that's happening to women as a national emergency. Enough women have died. It's really upsetting. We shouldn't be getting killed.
As our Sydney correspondent Phil Mercer explains, violence against women has been an issue for years.
A while ago, there were widespread demonstrations in this country demanding change to the way that women, for example, were being treated in the workplace and also the way that women were being treated in the national parliament 2 or 3 years ago. So certainly these sentiments aren't new, but we get the sense that the murders of those 5 women in that stabbing rampage at a place called Bondi Junction in Sydney a couple of weeks ago has further inflamed these sentiments. What protesters want is firstly tougher laws to protect women. The government here in Australia wants to, for example, review coercive control laws in this country and also bail applications from suspects with a history of violence. So no one knows for sure why this violence is continuing, but campaigners believe that tougher laws are part of the answer and also a cultural change on men's treatment of women and attitudes towards them in this country, because Australia often has this reputation of being a very macho and a very blokey place. For the people of Australia, they are hearing government figures that say that a woman is being killed on average every 4 days. There will be pressure on the Australian government, given that there's an election due in the next 12 months or so. This may well become an election issue, but for many, many Australians, it is already a burning social issue that demands a social and a political antidote.
Phil Mercer in Sydney. A hole in the ozone layer, the protective barrier of gas in the atmosphere, is causing problems for wildlife in the Antarctic. That's according to climate scientists in an article in the journal Global Change Biology. The hole usually appears annually, peaking in September or October, before closing once again in the Antarctic summer. But now scientists say the gap is bigger and is lasting longer, posing a threat to animals living there because of harmful UV rays which are coming through. As the lead researcher, Professor Sharon Robinson, told Rebecca Kesby.
The extra UV that comes through is particularly of concern in December, because that's when all of the animals and plants start growing and having chicks and seal pups and all of those sorts of things. So there's a lot more life in Antarctica in December than there is in September, which is when the ozone hole, it still opens then, but it's not so damaging at that time of year because there's not a snow cover over everything looking after it.
So just explain a little bit for us what the ozone layer does in terms of protecting us all and the harmful effect of UV rays and how they might be affecting the wildlife there.
The ozone layer is our primary protection from ultraviolet B radiation. And so when we have a nice thick layer of ozone in the stratosphere, that means that we get very little of the sun's UV radiation, especially UVB, reaching the Earth's surface. And that's important because UVB radiation in humans, it causes skin cancer, cataracts in our eyes. We don't think that seals and penguins will probably be getting skin cancer because they have feathers and fur, which probably protect them quite well. But their eyes could well be vulnerable to cataracts in the same way that we are. And we know that the plants have to make sunscreens if there's high UV, and that comes at a cost. So they can protect themselves, but they put more energy into protecting their cells from damage. And that means they've got less energy to grow and to reproduce.
And it's having an impact on some species' behaviour too, I understand. I was reading about krill, which is so central, isn't it, to all life in that area?
Yeah, the base of the food web, which feed the penguins and the seals and the whales. The krill basically are feeding on the edges of the sea ice. They're feeding off algae. They can actually take up some compounds from the algae that may give them some sun protection. But the main thing they seem to do is to dive deeper into the water. And that behavioral modification can then mean that, again, if they're deeper in the water, if they're not feeding as well, then that can affect the whole food chain.
Have you managed to work out what's causing this change in this hole?
We haven't done that work, but the main concern has been that the last 4 years, the ozone hole has extended into December. The first year that that happened was when we had really terrible bushfires here in Australia during the summer of 2019 and into 2020. And those fires were so intense that they put smoke up into the stratosphere, and those chemicals were able to accelerate the ozone depletion and cause the ozone hole to be bigger that year. And then we've had two large volcanic eruptions in the following 2 years. And those two volcanoes will also have put compounds into the stratosphere, like sulfates and water vapor, that again can help to accelerate ozone depletion. The concern now is that these additional compounds that are going into the stratosphere, potentially as a result of bushfires, will do damage and delay the recovery.
Climate biologist Professor Sharon Robinson. Cambodia's Prime Minister says 20 soldiers have been killed and several others injured in an explosion at an ammunitions depot in the south of the country. Here's Celia Hatton.
The only source of information on the deadly explosion appears to be Cambodia's Prime Minister, Hun Manet, who revealed the incident in a Facebook post. He said he was deeply shocked by Saturday afternoon's blast in the southern province of Kampong Speu, which also injured several others. No explanation has been given for the explosion, but Hun Manet said he had instructed his government to pay compensation of $20,000 to each family member that lost a soldier and their full funeral expenses. Cambodia has almost no independent media outlets, so more details of the incident will probably only be revealed if the government wishes to disclose them.
Celia Hatton. Ever since the James Webb Telescope was launched, it's come up with images of distant galaxies that have delighted astronomers. Now the telescope is investigating possible signs of life on a planet 124 light years from us here on Earth. The planet, called K2-18b, is causing lots of excitement because it seems to have a gas which scientists think can only be produced by living organisms. Simon Jack has been hearing more about this discovery from Niku Matsudan, a scientist at Cambridge University.
So this was last year when we saw tentative signs of this molecule, dimethyl sulfide. It was not robust at that time. So now, yesterday, we made the next observations with the James Webb Space Telescope that is going to tell us if the signal was real or not.
And what kind of life would produce this gas? Can it be only life that does it?
So on Earth, it is only life that does it, and it's mostly microorganisms in the Earth's oceans that produce this gas. We obviously don't know in another planet what else could be producing it, but so far, the only channels we know of on Earth are due to life, which is why this is a strong potential biosignature.
And are the conditions, I think it's called K2-18b, are they consistent with life as we know it?
So they're consistent with habitability in the sense that theoretical models have shown in the past that you could have a liquid water ocean on the planet with habitable conditions similar to what we have on Earth. So in that sense, it has the potential to sustain life. But whether it has life or not, we don't know, obviously, which is why we are making these observations.
And how unusual is it to find this gas?
So in an exoplanet, in a planet outside the solar system, we have never had anything like this before. In fact, this is the only planet currently known of all the thousands of planets, exoplanets we know. This is the only planet currently known which is potentially habitable and in whose atmospheres we have found other molecules like methane and CO2, carbon dioxide, we have found very robustly in this. So far in exoplanets, we don't have any false detections of this particular molecule. But obviously in the solar system, we have examples of some gases like phosphine of Venus on Venus and so on, which are being debated.
Professor Niku Matsudan from Cambridge University. And finally, has an airline ever lost your luggage or overbooked a plane so you can't travel when planned? Well, American Airlines GAF arguably beats both hands down by registering a passenger of 101 years old as a baby. Ella Bicknell picks up the tale.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome aboard American Airlines Flight 918.
Being 101 years old might stop you from doing a few things, but for Patricia, air travel is not one of them. So imagine the confusion and amusement after air stewards expected her to be a one-year-old baby.
They thought I was only a little child in here. I'm an old lady.
Patricia from Michigan's date of birth caused the airline computer system to malfunction and incorrectly register as a one-year-old infant. It was on a flight north from Chicago to Marquette that Patricia shared the exchange with the air crew. She told the BBC that it's a mix-up that's happened before.
They did it last year as well. They kept insisting that I was going to get a child's wheelchair.
Patricia's story has been a hit on social media with more than 1.7 million views on X. The centenarian has found it amusing on both occasions, but she says that she would like the glitch to stop as it causes problems when airport staff don't have cart transport ready for her. We asked American Airlines if they wanted to comment, but we've yet to receive a response. The former nurse flies every year to see family to escape the cold winters. She says on both occasions, the staff at American Airlines have been kind and helpful, in spite of the confusion. Patricia says that the mix-up isn't going to stop her from travel, with her next flight booked later this year, by which time she'll be 102.
Ella Bicknell reporting. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Abby Wiltshire. The producer was Emma Joseph. The editor, as ever, is Karen Martin. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.
Voiko vanhemmuuteen valmistautua? Mikä vauvakuplassa on totta ja mikä ei? Liberon odotushuone-podcastissa tehdään todellinen syväsukellus vanhemmuuden tiekarttaan. Minä olen Marja Hintikka ja tämä vanhemmuuden odotushuoneen ovi on aina auki, just sulle.